Have you ever wondered what you would get if you crossed a school teacher with a vampire hunter? You would get a character that almost always has a plan, rarely curses, but is willing to rip your heart out. The fantasy novel Blood Magic by R.L. Collins has been released on Amazon. Welcome to Blood Magic, the podcast. In this episode, Selena and the Guardians have an unexpected surprise in the jungle, and we meet a new character. At the temple, we found Ophelia in the infirmary serving meals to the wounded. She was much more casual in khakis and a sky blue camp shirt. Her white hair was piled loosely atop her head. She wasn't too surprised at meeting Saju and approved of his joining our team. I suppose when you're a human oracle, not too many things surprise you. She sent him along with Devlin to the men's quarters to prepare for our departure back to the States. I stayed behind to talk to her. I was still uncertain about my mission and wanted to talk to her alone. Ophelia served her last meal and suggested we take a walk together. Outside the infirmary, the people were milling about. The damage from the previous night's attack was repaired. This quiet community was very self-sufficient, with their common goal of protecting Ophelia. I glanced at her as we walked side by side. The recent events and loss of life seemed to have etched new lines in her face. Marcus knows your identity now, she sighed heavily. He will be much more desperate to have you. I feel unprepared for this, Ophelia, I said as we took a path, tracing the perimeter of the compound. I'm flying by the seat of my pants. She turned and looked at me steadily in the eyes. You have to believe in your own magic. He will not stop his destructive ways until you end him. If he can follow me here, he can follow me anywhere. Everyone around me is in danger. I ran a frustrated hand through my drying bob. Ophelia stopped and gripped me by my shoulders. The times ahead of you will only get more difficult. You must be fearless in your fight. Follow me. I think I have just the thing to help ease some of your worries. She led me to a modest structure a few yards from the temple. It blended in with all the other homes, but it was her special quarters. Inside, everything was decorated in jewel tones. She led me to a seating area. Lush, gauzy pillows replaced the need for chairs, and they surrounded a low, ashen wooden table. I sat on a plum pillow against the wall and watched Ophelia bustle around the room. She covered the table with an assortment of candles, a bowl of clear water, and a bone-white jewelry box. After a few minutes, she sat down in front of me. She arranged the candles in a semicircle around the bowl and jewelry box, then lit them one by one. I started to open my mouth to question her, but she held up a finger, reminding me to be patient. She took a deep breath, closed her eyes, and began chanting quietly. I felt a growing charge in the air. The candles flared with blue-white flames that illuminated her face. She was tense with concentration. I didn't understand the language she was chanting, but I was mesmerized by the tone and the reverence. The water in the bowl began to ripple as if crossed by a breeze. The room began to fill with an unseen power. I felt dizzy with the weight of it. I swayed on my pillow and braced my back against the wall. Ophelia's eyes flashed open as she quickly reached for the gleaming jewelry box and opened it. I pulled out a necklace of shining silver with a tear-shaped amber pendant. She held it over the rippling water and her chanting became more intense. Ophelia let the necklace slide into the water. It sizzled as it disappeared. I could hardly keep my eyes open. I was drunk on the power suffocating the room. Ophelia pulled the necklace out of the bowl and then was silent. The candle flames returned to the normal yellow-orange glow. The water ceased rippling. Power retreated into Ophelia. I found my breath eased, and I sat up straighter. Ophelia smiled triumphantly and got up to fetch a towel to dry off the necklace. This is yours, she beamed. This will help protect you and those around you in battle. I gingerly took the necklace and clasped it around my neck. The metal was cool and light against my skin. Now let's get you some dinner. Then you'll be on your way back home, she said as she clasped her hands together. By nightfall, we were back on our private jet, settled and comfortable in our seats and waiting for takeoff. Duncan had let Saju borrow some clothes and a baseball cap so he could blend in more easily. Although Saju was a few inches taller and packed with lean muscle from working outside, he also managed to find hair dye. His orange locks were now a dark chestnut brown. Our pilot, Jack, came overhead and announced that we needed to fasten our seatbelts and prepare for takeoff. Chow popped in earbuds for his iPod. Duncan reclined in his seat and started cleaning his weapons. Soju experimented with the control buttons for the movie that began to play overhead. I had a feeling that he would be fascinated by the entertainment center back at the Guardian's mansion. I took out my mother's journal and began to read. June 30th. We have lost half of our workers. They left out of fear of the jungle boogeyman. Ironically, we hadn't had any thefts in about 2 weeks since they left. The brave that remained are wondering if the culprit was among them. I know better. I haven't told anyone what I saw on the path the night I fainted. I knew it would only lead to more renewed fear. I hadn't seen the strange man since then either. Last night, Banju told us a story around the campfire, a jungle boogeyman story. It was a tale of a pale white demon with lion's teeth. It called to people while they are sleeping and lures them out of their homes into the jungle. The monster drains them of their blood. In the morning, the victims are often found in their beds, tucked in as if nothing happened except for two neat puncture marks on the neck. No one knows how the monster returns them without waking the families living in the same home. If I didn't know better, I'd say the Congolese tale was of a vampire. I almost want to laugh as I write this. Imagine a vampire existing in the wilds of the jungle and feeding off the natives. But I can't deny what I saw that night with the visitor and his malformed teeth. I will be braver next time I confront him. I know there will be a next time. My necklace began to heat up and give off a soft orange glow. Devlin turned to me. What is going on? I don't know, I gasped. Ophelia said this necklace would protect me and those around me from vampires. The necklace grew hotter and brighter. I stowed the journal in my pack and looked around the cabin. We were all on alert. Fear inched its icy way down my spine. I looked out the window next to my seat. Over the wing, there stood a dark figure with red glowing eyes. Vampire, I yelled, and that instant there was an explosion at the rear of the plane. White-hot flames disintegrated the rear of the plane. The air pressure dropped drastically, and the emergency air mask dropped from above our seats. Jack came on overhead and said in a strained voice, "We're making an emergency landing. Make sure you've got your seatbelts on, kiddos." Then we were plummeting from the sky. Devlin gripped my arm as my stomach rose and I tasted bile in my mouth. This was a nightmare come true. Crashing to my death on a plane with nowhere to run. Tree branches lunged through the windows, smashing the windows as we dove into a forest of some sort. The fire at the back of the plane was growing, and then the front crumpled from impact with a huge tree. The monster tree split the front of the plane down the middle. Glass, metal, and debris flew everywhere. The men ducked down and covered their faces with their arms as they shouted to one another. A few moments later, we stopped moving. We unlatched ourselves. Devlin and I ran to the door of the cockpit, or rather what was left of it. Through a hole punched open by debris into the dividing wall, we could see Jack's lifeless body mangled in the pilot's seat. The heat was too intense. The rest of us grabbed our gear. Soju wrenched the exit door off its hinges using his tiger strength, and then we were out. We jumped down several yards to sandy ground below. "This way," Chow called up ahead. "This way," Chow called up ahead, and we followed his voice through the dense foliage. We burst from the forest edge and ran onto a beach. The moon chose that moment to shine through. For miles and miles, all we could see was the black mirror of the ocean reflecting the fat moon above. The guardians and I were out safely, but where were we? And where was the vampire? Chapter 8. The men checked their cell phones for service. Of course, there was none. They left them on in case a call was able to make its way through. When we didn't arrive as scheduled in Virginia, hopefully the brothers at home would try to find us. We began to spread out from the forest. The beach was smooth and clear. There were no signs of other people. We began walking east, lugging our gear with us, hoping to find some sort of civilization. The moon climbed higher and higher in the sky during our journey. It flitted in and out from behind clouds. When the moon was hidden, I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. The fresh, cool air blew in on breezes, relieving some of the warmness of the night. Hours later, we were still walking, and dawn was upon us. We were tired, hungry, and needed to find a place to rest during the day. I spied a path leading from the beach into the soft dawn light. I suggested we take that path and see where it would lead us. The beach seemed to be never-ending. It was obvious we were on some sort of island. The day was heating up, but on the forested path, we were protected from the impending haze. Dappled light filtered through the treetops, I could hear birds in the house of primates in the canopy above. We walked another half mile until we could hear rushing water. The forest began to thin. We came out into a clearing in a pool fed by a beautiful rocky waterfall. Water cascaded down from a cliff reaching towards the sky. The pool below was clear, pristine, and filled with a rainbow of fish. We decided this would be a good spot to rest and dropped our gear. Chow and Duncan decided to search for firewood. Devlin set off to explore the perimeter for game animals to cook. Saju volunteered to go fishing. I rummaged around in my pack for a fresh pair of socks. I could feel blisters forming on the soles of my feet. Saju towered next to me, then his baseball cap dropped to the ground. It was quickly followed by his borrowed checkered shirt. I looked up and he already had his hands on the buttonfly of his jeans. His upper body was strong and covered in lean muscle like a dancer. He was almost hairless until the jeans revealed a thatch of copper-colored hair, starting at his navel and disappearing downward. He was starting to shove the jeans down over his hips. I felt my face heat, and I had to clear my throat twice before I could talk. "If you don't have on underwear underneath those jeans, then you'll be fishing in them." Saju's ebony eyes flashed, and he smiled slyly, saying, "As you wish." Mercifully, the jeans stayed on. "So how do you like your fish?" "My fish?" I wondered out loud. "Yes. Do you like them small and bite-sized, or big enough to sink your teeth into?" he asked while grinning mischievously at me. "Big enough to sink my teeth into," I found myself laughing. "Although I'm curious to see how you plan to catch fish with your bare hands." "More like with my claws," he said, as he held up his hand. He wiggled those long fingers at me until a haze wrapped around his hands. They morphed into something larger. I could hear the sharp cracking and popping of bones. Saju's graceful hands quickly transformed into lethal orange and black tiger paws, the very same paws I remember tearing through Devlin's shirt and into his flesh. "These are better than fishing poles," Saju promised. Then he loped off to the edge of the water. He waded in until he was waist deep and he stood very still. In no time, he began dipping those paws with lightning speed and catching large silvery blue fish. He threw them to the bank of the pool until we had more than enough for breakfast. "Is this enough for you?" he turned with a knowing smile. "That's more than enough," I called back to him. "Come join me," he suggested, as he dipped down and swam further out into the clear water. His movements were relaxed and graceful. I took off my shoes and socks and dipped my tired feet into the cool water. I began to wade out to Saju. His claws had returned to his masculine hands and he reached out to me. I was a few feet away when I felt something cold and scaly wrap around my waist. Saju shouted something at me. I looked down and saw a giant snake coiling itself around my body. Before I could draw a breath to scream, the monster dragged me under the water. I tried to dig my hands into the scales and pry it off, but it was useless. I couldn't see where the head began and the tail ended. The more I fought, the tighter the beast coiled around me and worked its way up my body. It constricted my chest and pushed out my last reserves of air. Then everything went black. Lips were moving against mine. Strong, sure lips were breathing air into my lungs. Then I was choking on water. Strong hands turned me on my side as I coughed up a sea of water until my chest was sore and tight and I had nothing left to give. Saju crouched above me looking very solemn and serious. "How do you feel?" he asked. Panicked, I sat up quickly looking around for the creature that attacked me. Floating along the edge of the water were bits and pieces of the snake. The draining blood colored the water purple. It looked like it had been forcefully ripped apart with someone's bare hands. Or bare claws, rather. "Selena," Saju called my name softly, gripped my shoulders, forcing me to look at him. "I'm alive," I croaked. "How did you?" Before I could finish my question, he was yanked out of my sight. Devlin had grabbed Saju by the hair and socked him right in the jaw. It was a terrible fight. Devlin yelled at him, "What have you done to her?" Chow and Duncan bounded out of the woods. Chow crouched down next to me. I couldn't talk above a whisper. But I told him what happened. Duncan tried to jump between them without getting hit himself. Finally, the two were separated. Devlin and Saju had bloody gashes and wounds all over their faces and upper bodies. Chow was finally able to tell Devlin what happened. Duncan waded into the murky water to throw a chunk of dead snake at Devlin's feet, corroborating the morning's events. Devlin flushed fiercely and stiffly walked over to me to ask me if I was okay. I was too mad at him to speak. I'd almost lost my life. Then I had to watch two grown men almost beat the crap out of each other.
Duncan and Chow handled things much more calmly and efficiently. They pulled out first aid kits from their gear and began tending to Saju and Devlin's wounds. They healed faster than normal humans. In no time, the bleeding had stopped and their skin was knitted back together. Devlin built a fire and began cooking the fish from Saju and the exotic squirrel that Devlin had found. Chow suggested we eat the snake too, but I was too disgusted to even look at it. I dug into my pack to find some dry clothes and managed to find a hidden spot around one of the mossy rocks by the water where I could change. We were all even more tired than before. Chow volunteered to stay up while the rest of us dozed. Thankfully, the rest of the day passed uneventfully. We rested peacefully by the water with our bellies full of food. A small fire kept away most of the forest animals. Around mid-afternoon, Chow switched guard duty with Duncan. At twilight, we were up and ready to move. We were packing our gear when I heard singing. I motioned to the men to pause and listen. The singing was getting louder as it came towards us. Then a woman came into the clearing a few yards away from us. She stared at us wide-eyed. She wore ripped-off, cut-off jeans, an old navy t-shirt, and was pleasantly plump. She had blue eyes and a mop of curly blonde hair. "Oh," she began, "I didn't know campers came out this far." "Hi," I perked up. "Our plane crashed a few miles from here. We're lost and have been trying to find civilization for some time," I ended with a smile. "Oh dear, is everyone okay?" she asked while scanning our team. I neglected to tell her about our deceased pilot, but gave her a thumb up. "Do you have a phone nearby that we could use?" I asked hopefully. "Why, yes, I do. My cabin is not far from here. I have a satellite phone. Come along with me." It was almost too good to be true. But I was desperate to get off this island. We finished gathering our gear and followed the blonde through the woods. She led us down another path away from the waterfall and deeper into the growing darkness. "My name is Selena," I offered as I walked alongside her, "and this is Duncan, Chow, Saju, and Devlin." "My name is Missy," she returned. She was quick and sure-footed on the path. "How long have you been stranded?" "About a day. We walked miles from the wreckage last night. You're the first person we've seen." There is a spa resort on the southern side of the island. It's full of tourists, and many of the natives work there, but I'm a real private person. I like to have my own space when I'm not working there on the weekends," she shared. Up ahead, I could see the lights of her cabin. It looked like a log cabin I might see camping in the woods of Virginia. In front, there was a modest flower garden. Along the side, there was a clothesline with fresh laundry hanging out to dry. Missy opened the door, which had been left unlocked, and welcomed us inside. It was a quaint but cozy home with the bare necessities. She sat us around the kitchen table and offered us some potato soup warming in a crock pot on the counter. Devlin left briefly to make a call on her satellite phone in the bedroom. Missy was very nice. She was thrilled to have visitors. She was bubbly and chatty. She said all the right things to make us feel warm and welcome. She lived on the island Tiki for 5 years now. She was a lounge singer at the resort and loved her job. She was also divorced with 2 teens, living with their father in Colorado back in the States. They flew out to see her several times a year. Devlin was unable to reach the others at the mansion, which was strange, but we were able to work around that. Missy made plans to take us to the resort early in the morning. We would catch a boat to the mainland and hopefully fly home the same day. Time whizzed by. We finished our dinner. We spent some time listening to the island radio station as they had a news hour, then played music by local bands. We played several rounds of Scrabble. The men loosened up. Chow suggested a card game of spades. "Oh, I almost forgot," Missy said, popping up from her perch by the sink. "It's supposed to rain tonight. I should bring my laundry in before it gets wet." Then she dashed out the door. We all sat around the dining room table, content and sipping on tall glasses of tea. Duncan was ribbing Devlin about his card skills during the last game of spades they played at home. My necklace began to glow and heat up against my skin. "Vampires," I gasped. Our gear was in Missy's bedroom. Before we crossed the living room, the door burst open. Vampires swarmed the cabin. In seconds, we were surrounded by fangs, claws, and guns. Thank you for listening. Tune in, same time, same place, to hear the tales of the next vampire battle.